Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. And it's one of those turning points in the year. Is it winter yet? It's pretty close. It's not. It's just the last days of fall, but a little earlier, maybe just a little touch earlier than usual, we're going to get a frost. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a pretty good frost across much of South Alabama. A pretty deep frost in some places, maybe even down into the mid-20s in some places. But I can just about guarantee that a lot of people around Mobile are probably going to get their first real good cold spell. And that freeze is going to hurt a lot of things above ground. But let's talk about cold weather, and let's talk about what it really means in a place like Alabama and in a place like the Gulf Coast. When certain things will be damaged and other things will actually get better. And I always feel like I need to do this because everybody gets really in this sort of, oh, cold is good, cold is bad. Cold is bad, bad, bad. It can't be anything good about it. But it actually, a lot of great things happen. And a lot of great things happen to your garden during this cold spell. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Let's talk about some of the good things, for example. And if you've been listening, and maybe you have, and you've been planting things like radishes and broccoli and collards and kohlrabi and beets and, oh, what are the other things? Turnips and collards and kale and arugula and carrots. I'm forgetting things. There's lots of other things you could have been planting. Mustard greens. Oh, my goodness. Mustard greens, of course. If you've been planting those kinds of things, this is going to be a big benefit. It's going to make things a whole lot easier from now on. And not only that, the thing to remember about cold weather is that the plants that survive it, and not all plants do, tomatoes won't, but the plants that survive cold weather survive it because they get sweeter. I know that sounds weird, but that's actually what happens. Survival of cool weather plants is because, for the most part, and I'm oversimplifying just a little bit, but not too much, they're converting starches into sugars. And the fact that those sugars make them more cold resistant is the reason why things like mustards and collards and turnips and carrots and lots of other things survive these cool spells and cold spells and just on the edge of freezing spells very, very well. Not only do they survive it, they actually get better for it. Cabbages. Oh my goodness, I forgot cabbages. Cabbages, of course, are going to be better because of this. And so it's good to remember this is going to make your garden better in a lot of ways if you've been paying attention, if you're doing the right kind of things. It won't be good for things like tomatoes. This will be the end of it. Basil will be completely shattered. No way. No way that you'll have basil. But you know what? You'll have things like parsley. Oh, I hope you have parsley. I hope you planted parsley because parsley is going to love this. And the flavor of parsley is going to, well, it's going to mellow out. It's not going to lose its intensity, but it is going to be rounder, more mellow as a result of these kinds of cool spells. It's going to be really nice. Won't have that bitterness. It'll be really nice as a result of these cool spells. A lot of things are going to benefit. Let's talk about some of the things that aren't going to benefit just a little bit. We'll take your questions here about specific plants. The things that may be bothered, and I'm worried about it because, as always, we tend to get these cold spells with after a lot of warmth. And when that happens, plants may not be prepared for it. So we do look for bark splitting. We do look for other things where plants' temperature changes are so rapid that the plant gets all confused. And the inside of the plant begins to separate from the outside of the plant, almost literally. And you get cracks in the bark, and you get other problems, lack of hardiness because of this sudden transition. So if you've got new plants, the plants that you just planted that are tender, things like, citrus and perhaps some other tender plants, it's probably a good idea to think about how to protect them on this night. Not because they can't tolerate cold at 32 degrees. Many of them can. Many oranges can. They'll do just fine. The trouble is that they won't have built up for it. They won't be ready for it because it's been so warm leading up to these conditions, and that's pretty typical. And most of the damage that I think that's done to citrus and to other things on the Gulf Coast and in South Alabama is the result of sudden changes in temperature, not how cold it was, but how suddenly the temperature changed. So it's a big deal right now. Hey, here's what I would suggest. If you've got some small plants, if you've got small, tender plants, plants like citrus, go ahead and throw something, cover them like an umbrella over the top. Don't tie it in at the base because you want to trap that ground heat. But if they're young, you might just cover them. You particularly want to cover the base. If the base has not been covered, you particularly want that to be covered up to about 12 inches. And you can do that lots of ways. One of the best ways to do it is with soil. Pull that soil back afterwards. If you've got mulch, you can just pile it on something to protect that graft. But it's even better if you can just throw a sheet over the top of a young citrus. What's a young citrus? Well, it's a citrus that's still small enough that you can throw a sheet over it. Right? Yeah, I mean, you're not going to do this over a really big citrus. It wouldn't be necessary even. But over smaller citrus, it's a smart thing to do. It would definitely help. So that's a good thing to do. Let me tell you about some other things that may survive. Basil won't. I don't even think at 32 degrees, I think it is just not worthwhile to even worry about protecting basil because it's so sensitive to cold. It's not going to grow much more anyway. You just say, basil's done for the year. I've got parsley. I'm good. Tomatoes, that's a trick. Maybe tomatoes could keep on and you could cover them. Here's the trick on that. Don't cover it so that when you cover it, don't let that cover touch the leaves. Peppers, same way. I'd keep peppers. There are a lot of peppers you could just about keep going right through Christmas, and there's a lot of good reasons to do that. You can keep a lot of good peppers, some of the peppers we've talked about, alive through the winter. All you need to do is cover the top during these cold spells. Just use a good sheet. But here's the trick, and I've found this over and over and over again. Make sure you put something so that the sheet doesn't touch the leaves. Sometimes, in fact, what I did yesterday is just went out and got a bunch of sticks, branches, fallen limbs that are a little bit arched, that are, when I lay them down on the ground, they're taller than the peppers and some of the other things I covered. And then I just lay the sheet right over that. And that way the sheet contacts the limbs and not the leaves of the peppers. where that sheet contacts the leaves, there will be a little bit more transfer of heat. You'll lose heat more quickly in those places, and that can be a problem. That can be a big problem. Let me tell you something else you're going to see, and you don't need to worry about it too much. With cold, hardy vegetables, like collards and cabbages and broccoli, you're going to see a little bit of change to the plant. You might see some of the leaves begin to look like they've been burned just a little bit, and that's because they haven't adjusted yet. But that's okay. They're going to survive. They're going to do fine. Hey, let's talk a little bit about it. We got other things we can talk about, too. Give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106.
All the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit more about what we mean by cold. There are a couple of things that happen with cold temperatures. Here's what happens to a plant with cold temperatures, and it's a combination of both losing heat and essentially losing moisture at the same time, because as a plant loses heat, the interior of the plant begins to freeze. The water begins to freeze. And what that means for the plant is, well, it may actually cause some minor explosions, but the bigger deal is that plants desiccate because they can't move water around anymore. And moving water around, it's like your blood freezes. And if your blood froze, you'd have a hard time. And when the blood freezes, the plant begins to desiccate. It begins to dry out. Now, here's what can compound the problem. Because the plant is already facing a problem of drying out because of the cold, when you get these winds, these high winds that accompany the cold, when it's near freezing, when it's at freezing, and when you're getting these high winds, it's like a double dose. I mean, it's drying the plant out. The plant is losing water faster. That means it freezes more easily. It's freezing more easily. That means it's more susceptible to water loss. It's just like a big tumble of issues for the plant. So one of the things that covering plants can do is just block the wind. And blocking the wind can be pretty important. If you've got, and I'm not sure what to tell you to do on cold hardy plants. I think there's a lot of issues. I think most cold hardy plants like collards, I think it's best just to leave them now. These are perfect temperatures for bringing them down to the temperature that they should be. But covering will make a lot of difference to young, tender plants that aren't used to this kind of cold, particularly things like citrus. And the covering works because not only because it keeps heat from being lost, but because it prevents the winds from desiccating those leaves and desiccating the plants further, drying them out. Sorry for using that word desiccated. I guess it's not necessary. But we're drying those plants out, and that can be a big problem. Specific questions now. About what's going on. Somebody said, should you protect your Okinawan spinach? It's a great question. You know, I've been surprised at how hardy Okinawan spinach has been for me in some years with just a little bit of cover. You know, I think your Okinawan spinach, you could probably keep picking it. We'd just throw some straw on top of it with these temperatures, and it'll probably do okay. It's a pretty tough customer. You won't lose it at these temperatures, that's for sure. You might have to stop picking it for the year, but you won't lose it at these temperatures. Covering it will keep it alive for a little while longer, and you can keep picking it. But Okinawan spinach does seem to be a little bit hardier, and its other relatives. Now, There's several relative things called Okinawan spinach, and it all depends on which one you're growing, I suspect. But my experience is it's reasonably hardy at these temperatures. It takes a bit more cold temperature to really affect those leaves, which are kind of thick and are low to the ground. And so it usually takes a little bit more of a cold spell. But I'd cover them. I'd cover them anyway. Certainly, that's something I'd do. Let's see here. I'm going to look. Hey, Ben, I'm listening. What's up? Ben, you there?
Bill, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. I live in Fairhope, about 500 feet from a park overlooking the Fairhope Pier. And just after daybreak on September 16th, four massive longleaf pines that I had just walked beneath the previous sunset really shook the ground as they fell one by one. They're about 9,500 feet tall, 2.5 feet wide. The rings are very, very interesting. One of them was 160 rings, 122, 115 rings. And the growth variation seemed to be in about 10 to 20 years first. I have a 15-inch thick section circa 1898 that weighs maybe 300 pounds or so. Is there a sawmill that can square it up at about 12 inches? And they're cracked. I knew it would dry. And the 3/4-inch thick bark is starting to fall out. How do I preserve this interesting artifact?
Yes, so indeed, you can get sawmills to make you a cant. There are some, I don't know which ones are still in operation. I know that there are some good sawmills in North Baldwin County that have been milling for a long time, and in South Monroe County. And, I don't have their names or their contacts. A lot of these local mills, it's not like they advertise, but yes, you can get it done. Maybe some of our callers can help us by talking about people who run mills where they do specialty work like that. One good thing is get the bark off as fast as you can, and lift the log off the ground. Bark means that you're going to see a lot more penetrations from insects. They're not going to get in very deep, but they can make it harder to deal with the wood. So take the bark off is kind of a standard procedure. Get that bark off, just shear it off the best you can. You can use some types of hose can be used to pull the bark off. They make special tools for doing it, but I'd get the bark off. And then lift it off the ground just a little bit. The sapwood on those trees will be more vulnerable to insect damage. You're probably going to cut most of that off when you make your cant, but still, not a good thing to leave it too close in contact with the ground. Yeah,
I've
that's cool.
I've got a slab on some triple fours, so it has air underneath it. How do I preserve the wood?
How do you preserve the wood?
Yeah.
Let me tell you something about longleaf. My dad took me back to our old home place in South Mississippi, not too far from the Alabama line, and there was a house. They had lived in several houses growing up, and they were particularly proud of this house. It was really well built in the teens and 20s, and it was built. They built the house of this beautiful oak, and it was going to be the best oak possible. Because that's what they were using in those days. They'd cut out all the longleaf, but boy, there was really great oak, and everybody was really happy with it. And oak, you know, lasts forever. So, but they when they built the house, they didn't have stones, they didn't have rocks, and they needed to put it on piers, and they didn't have bricks. So what they did was they rolled up a bunch of old longleaf stumps and built the house on top of those longleaf stumps. Just rolled the stumps up, built the house on top of them. And I went back and visited the house, which was a neat little house. The house had rotted to the ground. The stumps were still there. That tells you something about longleaf. A longleaf like you've got, that old, has so much resin in it, whatever you want to call it, so much What am I supposed to call it? What is Rhett, let me call it. Rhett Johnson says I have to use the right term, but we're going to call it resin. It has so much resin in it. It is so resinous that it is virtually nothing will eat it. And it's amazing how long it will last. So longleaf, old longleaf that's older than 75 years, it already has its own preservative in it. It's going to be very hard to see it go bad.
Well, I really appreciate that information. I hate to see those trees go, but they fell one by one, and they really shook the ground when they hit, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, did they go over from the roots?
Yes, they did. It's real interesting. I could tell which the order in which they fell by the direction. They didn't all fall exactly the same direction. And the tree started, they started cracking on the windward side about the lower 10 feet. And then I guess there was so much rain that they just toppled, snapping the top roots, and that they fell in their entirety. And one of them hit an oak tree with limbs 1 foot thick, and it shattered those limbs like they were 2 feet. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah. So were these, did these have really heavy, dense crowns? Or, I mean, was there a lot of foliage in the crown? Do you remember?
No. Yeah. Oh, yeah, in the crown, yes, they were. Yeah, significant foliage.
Yeah.
I walked beneath them the sunset the day before, and, you know, I never dreamed they'd be on the ground. Yes, they were. The canopies were really huge and thick.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I think that with a lot of these longleaf, we probably do need to thin the crowns a little bit to make sure that they persist for a long time. We've actually created conditions in which the crowns get a little thicker than normal. And when that happens, there's a lot of sail area way, 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 way up in the tree. And that may make them, that may create more leverage that helps to tip them out of the ground. It's interesting. I mean, one of the things about longleaf is the wood is so strong that sometimes it doesn't break off. A lot of times it will shed limbs or things in the upper crown. It just, the wood refuses to break. And when that happens, the roots themselves begin to lose traction. And so the whole tree grows over. But I think we could reduce that problem by thinning crowns. Well, hey, keep us posted. I hope we'll hear more about how you might be able to saw that cant.
Yes,
we'll be back. Stay tuned.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Get that mic right there in front of my face. Yeah, we were having a little bit of problems with streaming. Leanna fixed all that. Thank you. We're good now. Thanks for letting us know. Hey, we're talking a little bit about longleaf. Great pictures. Man, do I love that. Man, do I love that picture from the Chickasaw Swamp from Jim. It's a great house. Reminds me a little bit of the house that from our old place up the Chickasaw Hay. And a little farther north, I think, Jim, that from you. But it's a great, great old place on fat pine stumps, just this pine stumps rolled up under the house. And it says something about how much termites can do to those stumps. Nothing. It's just amazing. It's amazing. Now, don't try this with new longleaf. Don't try this with trees less than 75 years old. It won't work. They won't have developed enough of that pitch or rosin or sap or whatever you want to call it that hardens up and just becomes, you know, as I like to say, it'll break the tooth of a termite. Now, honestly, Termites don't have teeth. I know this. And so I don't mean that literally, but it's just a good old expression. It'll break the tooth of a termite. That's what longleaf will do. So it's pretty apt description, actually. It's just so hard. It's so dense. Cypress was a little different. Cypress wasn't as hard. But it had phenols in it, phenolic compounds that made it very distasteful to insects. And so old cypress, how old? I don't know. Probably around 200 years is when it began concentrating phenols to the point that it was really, really resistant to rot. So that's why we continue to look for those old cypress logs. But again, don't try this with new stuff. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. But it's pretty cool. David Hubble reminds me that it's time to begin thinking about the melatonin. It's been good. It's been a good year. Nearly 80, David says he's collected. He has harvested 80 fruits. I don't know. That's a lot of melatonin. But you know, the good thing is those fruits will sit around for a while, won't they, David? And some of them you can save for seeds. And you can be cooking them all winter, and with things like shrimp, and just I can imagine the wonderful things David's going to be cooking with those melatonin. But it's time to protect the vine, he says, and that's what he's doing. It's better to go ahead and trim it back so you can begin to cover it, so that you'll have a good vine. You know, it's interesting, David. I don't know whether damage to the tips of the vine, how quickly it'll spread to the roots. I think I might wait until I saw damage at the tips and saw a lot of damage, and then begin cutting it back, let it absorb some of those carbohydrates, reabsorb them into the roots. It's an interesting question. I don't know that we have a good answer for when we should cut it back. Protecting the vine is going to be really important when temperatures get down to around 28, 27 degrees. And to do that, you want the vine to have died back to the ground. Is this the right temperature to do it? I don't know. It's always an interesting experiment. David is doing the most experimentation, so I'm going to follow his lead. And he's cutting his stuff back right now. John, did you send me a picture of this tree, John, that you want to know something about?
Well, probably not today.
Yep. So tell me about it.
It looks to be a mature tree. The bark on it is just, to me, strange. It's not like an oak or a river birch or anything like that. And it's also symmetrical. And it's the only tree in that lot.
What's the lot now? Tell me about it. Give me a little more hint.
Well, I mean, you know where Old Shell Road is.
Okay, so I've missed something.
It's where Old Shell Road crosses Ann Street.
Where Old Shell crosses Ann. Okay, let me.
So
where
it,
Old Shell
it's
crosses
the south,
right?
Corner.
Right in front of the old, what used to be the old, the white, that white cinder block building, right?
I don't know.
You don't know. But anyway, that's okay.
To the tree, I guess.
So Ann and Oldfield. So here's what I think you're looking at. And here's how I know it. Because when I would ride my bike by there, I'd think, God, this smells like Mardi Gras. I mean, and when I mean that, I mean like the morning after Mardi Gras. You know how bad that smell is when you'd smell it at certain times of year? And
oh, yeah.
I think, you know, a bunch of people got really drunk and just kind of unloaded here. That's what it smells like. And then I thought, what in the world is going on this corner? And then I looked up, and there was the tree. And you know what that tree is?
Mardi Gras tree.
It's a Mardi Gras tree. No, I just forgot the name of the tree. It's the I'll think of it in just a second. It's fiddledy-dee. Beth, what is the name of the tree that has the gold leaves in fall? Ginkgo, thank you. My goodness. It's a ginkgo tree. It's a ginkgo tree, G-I-N-K-O, and G-I-N-G-K-O. And it has, it's a female ginkgo, so when the fruits drop, it really smells. The fruits ripen, and they really stink. But it's a ginkgo tree, and the leaves were pretty gold when they fell. Did you notice that?
No.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're incredible.
I'm not by there every day. It's just occasionally I'm by there, and I'm like, what in the world is this? Is that a native type thing, or is it somebody?
No, it's actually, you know, there's a question as to whether it exists in the wild anywhere. It's a very ancient tree, and it was thought to be lost.
It's a biblical tree, right?
No, I wouldn't. I don't think anybody in the Bible. I don't think it's mentioned in the Bible.
Okay.
It was actually found around Buddhist temples, in China. And so it's biblical in the sense that it's Buddhist biblical, and maybe Tibetan biblical or whatever. But it was a sacred tree in China, and it was preserved. I don't think it grows wild in the forest anymore. It was only preserved around these old monasteries, and it's one of the oldest trees known. It really is very, very old. It dates back into the Jurassic. It's virtually a dinosaur tree, but it has been preserved and spread around, and it grows fairly well in a lot of places and grows well in Mobile.
Well,
as you can see,
very well.
Yeah, it's really tall and really big, and it'll keep growing. Eventually, it'll flat top. I've seen them really, really old in some old southern cities. And they have a really, you kind of forget that they're ginkgos because the leaves, it loses all of its lower branches and all the leaves get way up in the crown. But they can be absolutely beautiful when they drop their leaves. But I'm pretty sure the tree you're talking about is a ginkgo. And I know this because I remember vividly passing by it when the fruits were ripening on the ground.
Well, I appreciate that so much. I really do.
All right, look for those leaves when they fall next year, John. They're
I
really
will.
Beautiful. All right.
Have a great day.
You too. You too. So speaking of trees, Patrick sent me a picture of a tree growing in his, it's a bay, one of many bays, growing in a swamp, and he actually sent me a picture of more than one kind of bay. And so the one with the silver underneath the leaves, the one that's silvery underneath the leaves, Patrick, is the second picture that you sent me with silver underneath the leaves. That is a magnolia. That is Sweet Bay Magnolia, pretty clearly. No problem. Absolutely 100% Sweet Bay Magnolia. Now, as I move down the page, you've sent me a picture of another tree that is different. And that one is horse sugar, Symplocus tinctoria, horse sugar. And I believe that's what it is. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. It could be wild olive, but I think it's horse sugar. So, you've got at least a couple of different kinds of trees that I'm looking at, but the, that second group of pictures, no question that is a Sweet Bay Magnolia. I would not use the Sweet Bay Magnolia for cooking. I would use the Red Bay for cooking, and I don't see a picture of Red Bay that you've sent me. But keep looking. You may find a Red Bay. Red Bay will have purple underneath the leaves. The undersides of the leaves will be purplish, and quite delicious. That bottom set of leaves, one thing you can do is chew on them. If they have a kind of a sweet flavor, if the flavor is a little bit sweet, kind of like sweet tea with a little bit of lemon added, then it's Symplocus. It's horse sugar. It's that tree, that bay. All right, we're going to be back. And I'm going to remember the name of Ginkgo. My goodness.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yay, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. You know, one of the things to think about, and I encourage you all to think about very carefully, is how much the temperature varies in a small area. I want to say particularly along the Gulf Coast. It varies less in central Alabama, but particularly along the Gulf Coast, it can vary a lot over a small distance. So what's interesting is that areas around Bellingrath, they're going to stay pretty warm. They may not even get down to freezing. There may be areas in Midtown Mobile that don't ever get to freezing. It's going to be pretty close, though. I think there probably are. I think Fairhope will probably get down to freezing, right at freezing. But you know what? At Citronelle, it's going to be cold, 27 degrees, pretty solidly 27 degrees. If you're moving up to Jackson, you're probably going to get a low of around, mid-20s. And that'll be about as cold as it'll be in North Alabama. How is that? You know, you could go up to the northernmost part of Alabama. It won't be much colder than it'll be in Jackson, Alabama. So the temperature varies a lot depending on where you are depending on when the front comes in and other things. So be aware of that. We've always tried to encourage you. One of the places you can go, we have this thing in America, and it's a really cool thing, and it's something we should think about more often. It's called the National Weather Service. And the National Weather Service is a very reliable source of information about where you are. And unlike a lot of apps and a lot of information you get from TV and other places, you can go to the National Weather Service forecast and you can punch in your zip code and you'll get a pretty good forecast that is specific to your area. So take a look at that, and it'll give you a little better appreciation for what the temperature is going to be where you are. Because it could range, you know, from Jackson, Alabama, down in the mid-20s, all the way up to not even freezing around Bellingrath. And goodness gracious, who knows what's going to happen on Dolphin Island. Probably no freezing at all on Dolphin Island. So there's a lot of variation in the range of temperatures across our area, and it's good to think about that. So what's it going to do to your plants? We'll talk a little bit more about that this morning. Lemons. Should you pick all your lemons? You know, if you live in Midtown, I wouldn't pick all my lemons. I wouldn't pick all my Meyer's lemons because lemons are pretty thick. They're fairly resistant to freezing. The temperature is going to be just right to maybe set them to set the clock on that lemon so that it will be a little better prepared for the next cold spell. But what I would do, and here's what I would do, if I could just cover that lemon tree, and I assume it's a Meyer's lemon, if I could just cover that Meyer's lemon with a sheet, I'd do it. Because you'll probably preserve most of your lemons. You'll probably retain most of the heat. It'll be just fine, and it'll get just enough cold. Everything will be fine. But I don't think I would pick half of them if you want, but I don't think the lemons themselves are going to freeze because they're pretty thick fruits. If it's something besides a Meyer's lemon, we got to be a little bit more careful. So you can call me, and we can talk about it. Meyer's lemons and regular lemons are two very different things in terms of their hardiness and in terms of how you use them and just for a whole lot of reasons. Nancy, you've been holding on for a while. Thank you. I'm listening. What's up?
A while back you talked about mulching with weeds, so I just wanted you to elaborate on that. And also, can I put weeds in my compost pile?
Yes. So here's an interesting thing I do. I do mulch with weeds. Certainly if they're the kind of weeds that tends to root in very easily, I would be careful about it. But most weeds don't. When you pull them, they're just fine. And even if they have seeds on them, I make a pile, and all those seeds drop below to the bottom of the pile. And because most weeds require light to germinate, they just sit there. And the weeds break down and make really great soil, and they bury the weed seeds. And as long as you don't till that area up, which I try to refrain from doing for a lot of reasons, you'll never see those weeds again or the weed seeds. So, and weeds make incredibly good material because they got all the minerals. They're much better at collecting minerals and other things. So does that make sense? I just make a little pile, maybe a foot high, maybe 18 inches high of just weeds that I've pulled in a little single area. The weed seeds, if there are any weed seeds, they're going to drop down into that pile, filter down, and they're going to get buried as the weeds break down, and they won't be a problem as long as you don't till it. Can you put it in
Wonderful.
Your compost?
Yeah.
Compost a little different. I don't have a separate compost pile. I try to discourage that because it misses the point. Most of the stuff that's happening in terms of things breaking down is happening underneath the compost. So all the good stuff from the compost is underneath the compost pile. So the key is build your compost pile where you're going to plant your garden. And that means it doesn't. And if you do that, you can add weed seeds to it. Just make sure that those weeds, that you don't till that soil and that you don't move it. If you have to move your compost bed, then I wouldn't recommend it. Does that make sense?
Because I have heard you say that before, that you compost where you plant. Perfect.
Right. Right. And that's always the way to do it in the South. Up north, I think it doesn't matter because I think compost doesn't matter as much. Down here,
yes.
Organic matter matters a lot, and you want it to have it all right where you're planting. You don't want to waste any of it, and it will break down pretty quick, and it's going to all go into the ground because right where the compost pile is. So there's the key.
Thank you.
All right. Call us back Bye. If you've got any more questions. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dan just drove by that ginkgo, and sorry, I had to consult my local tree expert, my wife, to remember the name of the ginkgo. How could I forget that? You know, the other problem you have with ginkgo is you have to remember how to spell it, and it's just not at all rational. Well, maybe it is rational. It's just not intuitive. G-I-N-G-K-O. G-I-N-G-K-O. Ginkgo biloba for improving memory. Yes, thank you for that. Ginkgo bilboa? No, ginkgo biloba, actually, I think is what it is. It's two lobes. B-I-L-O-B-A. Ginkgo, G-I-N-G-K-O. G-K-O. It's a tough speller there. It's a tough one. There it is. So that's good. Let me get back to some of these other questions. Michael Neal asked me, what were the tomato varieties from Guatemala you recommended? And so Santiago is one that I really love. I really love it. There are a couple of Santiagos out there, but I think the Santiago I got was from Adaptive Seeds. I will look that up and let you know where you can get it. But we're going to take a break. Vern, hold on, because we're going to be right back after we do the news and a few other things.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song on the radio.